part of his mind. He hadn't even been aware of that part in him until that afternoon in Deering Oaks. Had an answer for everything. And in the dark, it didn't seem to matter that most of the answers were irrational. He was doing a slow dance back and forth between two sharpened points. Kemp on one. Do you have any questions? A vision of the telephone ringing on and on in their empty Castle Rock house on the other. She could have had an accident. She and Tad could be in the hospital. Someone could have broken in. They could be lying murdered in their bedrooms. Of course, if she'd had an accident, someone official would have been in touch. The office, as well as Donna, knew in which Boston hotel he and Roger were staying. But in the dark, that thought, which should have been a comfort since no one had been in touch, only inclined his thoughts more toward murder. Robbery and murder, his mind whispered as he lay awake in the dark. Then it danced slowly across to the other sharpened point and took up its original litany, "Gone off with Kemp." In between these points, his mind saw a more reasonable explanation, one that made him feel helplessly angry. Perhaps she and Tad had decided to spend the night with someone and had simply forgotten to call and tell him. Now it was too late to start calling around and asking people without alarming them. He supposed he could call the sheriff's office and ask them to send someone up and check, but wouldn't that be overreacting? No, his mind said. Yes, his mind said, definitely. She and Tad are both dead with knives stuck in their throats, his mind said. You read about it in the papers all the time. It even happened in Castle Rock just before we came to town. That crazy cop, that Frank Dodd. Gone off with Kemp, his mind said. At midnight, he tried again, and this time the constant ringing of the phone with no one to pick it up froze him into a deadly certainty of trouble. Kemp, robbers, murderers, something. Trouble. Trouble at home. He dropped the phone back into its cradle and turned on the bed lamp. Roger, he said. Wake up.
Huh? Huzz.
Roger had his arm over his eyes, trying to block out the light. He was in his pajamas with the little yellow college pennants. Roger! Roger! Roger opened his eyes, blinked, looked at the travelette clock.
Hey, Vic, it's the middle of the night.
Roger. He swallowed, and something clicked in his throat. Roger. It's midnight, and Tad and Donna still aren't home. I'm scared. Roger sat up and brought the clock close to his face to verify what Vic had said. It was now 4 past the hour.
Well, they probably got freaked out staying there by themselves, Vic. Sometimes Althea takes the girls and goes over to Sally Petrie's when I'm gone. She gets nervous when the wind blows off the lake at night, she says.
She would have called. With the light on, with Roger sitting up and talking to him, the idea that Donna might have just run off with Steve Kemp seemed absurd. He couldn't believe he had ever even indulged it. Forget logic. She had told him it was over, and he had believed her. He believed her now.
Called?
Roger said. He was still having trouble tracking things.
She knows I call home almost every night when I'm away. She would have called the hotel and left a message if she was going to be gone overnight. Wouldn't Althea?
Roger nodded.
Yeah, she would.
She'd call and leave a message so you wouldn't worry. Like I'm worrying now.
Yeah. But she might have just forgotten, Vic.
Still, Roger's brown eyes were troubled.
Sure, Vic said. On the other hand, maybe something's happened. She carries ID, doesn't she?
If she and Tad were in an accident, God forbid, the cops would try home first and then the office. The answering service would...
I wasn't thinking about an accident, Vic said. I was thinking about...
His voice began to tremble.
I was thinking about her and Tatter being there alone and... Shit, I don't know. I just got scared, that's all.
Call the sheriff's office, Roger said promptly.
Yeah, but
nothing. You aren't going to scare Donna, that's for sure. She's not there.
But what the hell? Set your mind at rest. It doesn't have to be sirens and flashing lights. Just ask if they can send a cop by to check and make sure that everything looks normal. There must be 1,000 places she could be. Hell, maybe she just tied into a really good Tupperware party.
Donna hates Tupperware parties.
So maybe the girl's got playing penny ante poker and lost track of the time, and Tad's asleep in someone's spare room.
Vic remembered her telling him how she had steered clear of any deep involvement with the girls. I don't want to be one of those faces you see at the bake sales, she had said. But he didn't want to tell Roger that. It was too close to the subject of Kemp.
Yeah, maybe something like that, Vic said. Have you got an extra key to the place tucked away somewhere? There's one on a hook under the eave on the front porch. Tell the cops. Someone can go in and have a good look around. Unless you've got pot or coke or something you'd just as soon they didn't stumble over.
Nothing like that.
Then do it, Roger said earnestly. She'll probably call here while they're out checking and you'll feel like a fool, but sometimes it's good to feel like a fool. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Vic said, grinning a little. Yeah, I do.
He picked the telephone up again, hesitated, then tried home again first. No answer. Some of the comfort he had gotten from Roger evaporated. He got directory assistance from Maine and jotted down the number of the Castle County Sheriff's Department. It was now nearly 12:15 on Wednesday morning. Donna Trenton was sitting with her hands resting lightly on the steering wheel of the Pinto. Tad had finally fallen asleep again, but his sleep was not restful. He twisted, turned, sometimes moaned. She was afraid he was reliving in his dreams what had happened earlier. She felt his forehead. He muttered something and pulled away from her touch. His eyelids fluttered and then slipped closed again. He felt feverish, almost surely a result of the constant tension and fear. She felt feverish herself, and she was in severe pain. Her belly hurt, but those wounds were superficial, little more than scratches. She had been lucky there. Cujo had damaged her left leg more. The wounds there, the bites, her mind insisted, as if relishing the horror of it, were deep and ugly. They had bled a lot before clotting, and she hadn't tried to apply a bandage right away, although there was a first aid kit in the Pinto's glove box. Vaguely, she supposed she had hoped that the flowing blood would wash the wound clean. Did that really happen, or was it just an old wives' tale? She didn't know. There was so much she didn't know. So goddamn much. By the time the lacerated punctures had finally clotted, her thigh and the driver's bucket seat were both tacky with her blood. She needed 3 gauze pads from the first aid kit to cover the wound. They were the last 3 in the kit. Have to replace those, she thought. And that brought on a short, hysterical fit of the giggles. In the faint light, the flesh just above her knee had looked like dark, plowed earth. There was a steady, throbbing ache there that had not changed since the dog bit her. She had dry-swallowed a couple of aspirin from the kit, but they didn't make a dent in the pain. Her head ached badly, too, as if a bundle of wires were slowly being twisted tighter and tighter inside each temple. Flexing the leg brought the quality of the pain up from the throbbing ache to a sharp, glassy beat.
She had no idea if she could even walk on the leg now, let alone run for the porch door. And did it really matter? The dog was sitting on the gravel between her car door and the door which gave on the porch, its hideously mangled head drooping, but with its eyes fixed unfailingly on the car. On her. Somehow she didn't think Cujo was going to move again, at least not tonight. Tomorrow the sun might drive him into the barn, if it was as hot as it had been yesterday. "It wants me," she whispered through her blistered lips. It was true. For reasons decreed by fate, or for its own unknowable ones, the dog wanted her. When it had fallen on the gravel, she had been sure it was dying. No living thing could have taken the pounding she had given it with the door. Even its thick fur hadn't been able to cushion the blows. One of the St. Bernard's ears appeared to be dangling by no more than a string of flesh. But it had regained its feet, little by little. She hadn't been able to believe her eyes. Hadn't wanted to believe her eyes. "No!" she had shrieked, totally out of control. "No! Lie down! You're supposed to be dead! Lie down! Lie down and die, you shit dog!" "Mommy, don't," Tad had murmured, holding his head. "It hurts. It hurts me." Since then, nothing in the situation had changed. Time had resumed its former slow crawl. She had put her watch to her ear several times to make sure it was still ticking, because the hands never seemed to change position. 12:20. "What do we know about rabies, class?" Precious little. Some hazy fragments that had probably come from Sunday supplement articles, a pamphlet leafed through idly back in New York when she had taken the family cat Dinah for her distemper shot at the vet's. Excuse me, distemper and rabies shots. Rabies, a disease of the central nervous system, the good old CNS, causes slow destruction of same. But how? She was blank on that, and probably the doctors were, too. Otherwise, the disease wouldn't be considered so damn dangerous. Of course, she thought hopefully, I don't even know for sure that the dog is rabid. The only rabid dog I've ever seen was the one Gregory Peck shot with a rifle in To Kill a Mockingbird. Except, of course, that dog wasn't really rabid. It was just pretend. It was probably some mangy mutt they'd gotten from the local pound, and they put Gillette Foamy all over him. She pulled her mind back to the point. Better to make what Vic called a worst-case analysis, at least for now. Besides, in her heart she was sure the dog was rabid. What else would make it behave as it had? The dog was as mad as a hatter. And it had bitten her, badly. What did that mean? People could get rabies, she knew, and it was a horrible way to die, maybe the worst. There was a vaccine for it, and a series of injections was the prescribed method of treatment. The injections were quite painful, although probably not as painful as going the way the dog out there was going. But she seemed to remember reading that there were only two instances where people had lived through an advanced case of rabies, a case, that is, that had not been diagnosed until the carriers had begun exhibiting symptoms. One of the survivors was a boy who had recovered entirely. The other had been an animal researcher who had suffered permanent brain damage. The good old CNS had just fallen apart. The longer the disease went untreated, the less chance there was. She rubbed her forehead, and her hand skidded across a film of cold sweat. How long was too long? Hours? Days? Weeks? A month, maybe? She didn't know. Suddenly the car seemed to be shrinking.
It was the size of a Honda, then the size of one of those strange little three-wheelers they used to give disabled people in England, then the size of an enclosed motorcycle sidecar, finally the size of a coffin, a double coffin for her and Tad. They had to get out! Get out! Get out!
Her hand was fumbling for the door handle before she got hold of herself again. Her heart was racing, accelerating the thudding in her head.
Please, she thought. It's bad enough without claustrophobia, so please, please, please.
Her thirst was back again, raging. She looked out, and Cujo stared implacably back at her, his body seemingly split in two by the silver crack running through the window.
Help us, someone, she thought. Please, please help us.
Roscoe Fisher was parked back in the shadows of Jerry Sitko when the call came in. He was ostensibly watching for speeders, but in actual fact he was cooping. At 12:30 on a Wednesday morning, Route 117 was totally dead. He had a little alarm clock inside his skull, and he trusted it to wake him up around 1 when the Norway drive-in let out. Then there might be some action.
Unit 3, come in. Unit 3, over.
Roscoe snapped awake, spilling cold coffee in a styrofoam cup down into his crotch.
Oh, shit fire,
Roscoe said dolefully.
Now that's nice, isn't it? Key Christ. Unit 3, you copy? Over.
He grabbed the mic and pushed the button on the side.
I copy, base.
He would have liked to have added that he hoped it was good because he was sitting with his balls in a puddle of cold coffee, but you never knew who was monitoring police calls on his or her trusty Bearcat scanner, even at 12:30 in the morning.
Want you to take a run up to 83 Latch Street, Billy said. Residence of Mr. and Mrs. Victor Trenton. Check the place out. Over. What am I checking for, base? Over. Trenton's in Boston and no one's answering his calls. He thinks someone should be home. Over. Well, that's wonderful, isn't it? Roscoe Fisher thought sourly.
For this, I got a $4 cleaning bill.
And if I do have to stop a speeder, the guy's going to think I got so excited at the prospect of a collar that I pissed myself. 10-4 and time out, Roscoe said, starting his cruiser. Over. I make it 12:34 a.m., Billy said. There's a key hanging on a nail under the front porch eave, Unit 3. Mr. Trenton would like you to go right on inside and look around if the premises appear deserted. Over. Roger, base. Over and out.
Out.
Roscoe popped on his headlights and cruised down Castle Rock's deserted main street, past the common and the bandstand with its conical green roof. He went up the hill and turned right on Larch Street near the top. The Trentons was the second house from the corner, and he saw that in the daytime they would have a nice view of the town below. He pulled the Sheriff's Department Fury 3 up to the curb and got out, closing the door quietly. The street was dark, fast asleep. He paused for a moment, pulling the wet cloth of his uniform trousers away from his crotch, grimacing as he did it, and then went up the driveway. The driveway was empty, and so was the small one-car garage at the end of it. He saw a Big Wheels trike parked inside. It was just like the one his own son had. He closed the garage door and went around to the front porch. He saw that this week's copy of the call was leaning against the porch door. Roscoe picked it up and tried the door. It was unlocked. He went onto the porch, feeling like an intruder. He tossed the paper on the porch glider and pushed the bell beside the inner door. Chimes went off in the house, but no one came. He rang twice more over a space of about 3 minutes, allowing for the time it would take the lady to wake up, put on a robe, and come downstairs, if the lady was there. When there was still no answer, he tried the door. It was locked.
Husband's away, and she's probably staying over with friends, he thought.
But the fact that she hadn't notified her husband also struck Roscoe Fisher as mildly strange. He felt under the peaked eave, and his fingers knocked off the key Vic had hung up there not long after the Trentons had moved in. He took it down and unlocked the front door. If he had tried the kitchen door, as Steve Kemp had that afternoon, he could have walked right in. Like most people in Castle Rock, Donna was slipshod about buttoning up when she went out. Roscoe went in. He had his flashlight, but he preferred not to use it. That would have made him feel even more like an unlawful intruder, a burglar with a large coffee stain on his crotch. He felt for a switch plate and eventually found one with two switches. The top one turned on the porch light, and he turned that one off quickly. The bottom one turned on the living room light. He looked around for a long moment, doubting what he was seeing. At first he thought it must be some trick of his eyes, that they had not adjusted to the light or something. But nothing changed, and his heart began to pump quickly. "Mustn't touch anything," he thought. "Can't balls this up." He had forgotten about the wet coffee splotch on his pants, and he had forgotten about feeling like an intruder. He was scared and excited. Something had happened here, all right. The living room had been turned topsy-turvy. There was shattered glass from a knick-knack shelf all over the floor. The furniture had been overturned. The books had been scattered every which way. A big mirror over the fireplace was also broken. 7 years bad luck for somebody, Roscoe thought, and found himself thinking suddenly and for no reason about Frank Dodd, with whom he had often shared a cruiser. Frank Dodd, the friendly small-town cop, who had just happened to also be a psycho who murdered women and little children. Roscoe's arms broke out in a goose flesh suddenly. This was no place to be thinking about Frank. He went into the kitchen through the dining room, where everything had been swept off the table. He skirted that mess carefully. The kitchen was worse. He felt a fresh chill creep down his spine. Someone had gone absolutely crazy in here. The doors to the bar cabinet stood open, and someone had used the length of the kitchen like a pitch-till-you-win alley at a county fair. Pots were everywhere, and white stuff that looked like snow but had to be soap powder. Written on the message board in large and hurried block letters was this: "I left something upstairs for you, baby." Suddenly, Roscoe Fisher didn't want to go upstairs. More than anything else, he didn't want to go up there. He had helped clean up three of the messes Frank Dodd had left behind him, including the body of Mary Kate Henderson, who had been raped and murdered on the Castle Rock bandstand in the common. He never wanted to see anything like that again. And suppose the woman was up there, shot, or slashed, or strangled. Roscoe had seen plenty of mayhem on the roads, and had even got used to it after a fashion. 2 summers ago, he and Billy and Sheriff Bannerman had pulled a man out of a potato grading machine in pieces, and that had been one to tell your grandchildren about. But he had not seen a homicide since the Henderson girl, and he did not want to see one now. He didn't know whether to be relieved or disgusted by what he found on the Trentons' bedspread. He went back to his car and called in. When the telephone rang, Vic and Roger were both up, sitting in front of the TV, not talking much, smoking their heads off. Frankenstein, the original film, was on. It was 1:20. Vic grabbed the phone before it had completed its first ring. "Hello, Donna, is this Mr. Trenton?" A man's voice. "Yes." "This is Sheriff Bannerman, Mr. Trenton. I'm afraid I have some rather upsetting information for you. I'm sorry." "Are they dead?" Vic asked. Suddenly, he felt totally unreal and two-dimensional, no more real than the face of an extra glimpsed in the background of an old movie, such as the one he and Roger had been watching. The question came out in a perfectly conversational tone of voice. From the corner of his eye, he saw Roger's shadow move as he stood up quickly. It didn't matter. Nothing else did either. In the space of the few seconds that had passed since he had answered the phone, he had had a chance to get a good look behind his life, and had seen it was all stage scenery and false fronts.
"Mr. Trenton, Officer Fisher was dispatched. Dispense with the official bullshit and answer my question. Are they dead?"
He turned to Roger. Roger's face was gray and wondering. Behind him on the TV, a phony windmill turned against a phony sky.
"Rog, got a cigarette?"
Roger handed him one.
"Mr. Trenton, are you still there?"
"Yes.
Are they dead?"
"We have no idea where your wife and son are as of right now," Bannerman said, and Vic suddenly felt all of his guts drop back into place. The world took on a little of its former color.
He began to tremble. The unlit cigarette jittered between his lips.
"What's going on? What do you know? You're Bannerman, you said?"
"Castle County Sheriff, that's right. And I'll try to put you in the picture if you'll give me a minute."
"Yes, okay."
Now he was afraid. Everything seemed to be going too fast.
"Officer Fisher was dispatched to your home at 83 Latch Street as per your request at 12:34 this morning. He ascertained that there was no car in the driveway or in the garage. He rang the front doorbell repeatedly, and when there was no answer, he let himself in using the key over the porch eave. He found that the house had been severely vandalized. Furnishings were overturned, liquor bottles broken, soap powder had been poured over the floor and the built-ins of the kitchen."
"Jesus, Kemp," Vic whispered.
His whirling mind fixed on the note, "Do you have any questions?" He remembered thinking that note, regardless of everything else, was a disquieting index into the man's psychology, a vicious act of revenge for being dumped. What had Kemp done now? What had he done besides go through their house like a harpy on a warpath?
"Mr. Trenton?
I'm here."
Bannerman cleared his throat as if he were having some difficulty with the next.
"Officer Fisher proceeded upstairs. The upstairs had not been vandalized, but he found traces of, some whitish fluid, most probably semen, on the bedspread in the master bedroom."
And in an unwitting comic ellipsis, he added,
"The bed did not appear to have been slept in."
"Where's my wife?" Vic shouted into the phone. "Where's my boy? Don't you have any idea?"
"Take it easy," Roger said, and put a hand on Vic's shoulder. Roger could afford to say take it easy. His wife was home in bed. So were his twin girls. Vic shook the hand off.
"Mr. Trenton, all I can tell you right now is that a team of state police detectives are on the scene, and my own men are assisting. Neither the master bedroom nor your son's room appear to have been disturbed."
"Except for the cum on our bed, you mean," Vic said savagely,
and Roger flinched as if struck. His mouth dropped open in a gape.
"Yes, well, that," Bannerman sounded embarrassed. "But what I mean is that there are no signs of, violence against person or persons. It looks like straight vandalism."
"Then where are Donna and Tad?"
The harshness was now breaking up into bewilderment, and he felt the sting of helpless little boy tears at the corners of his eyes.
"At this time, we have no idea."
"Kemp. My God, what if Kemp has them?"
For just a moment, a confusing flash of the dream he'd had the previous night recurred. Donna and Tad hiding in their cave, menaced by some terrible beast. Then it was gone.
If you have any idea of who might be behind this, Mr. Trenton...
I'm going out to the airport and rent a car, Vic said. I can be there by 5 o'clock.
Patiently, Bannerman said, Yes, Mr. Trenton, but if your wife and son's disappearance is somehow connected with this vandalism, time could be a very precious commodity. If you have even the slightest idea of who might bear a grudge against you and your wife, either real or imagined.
Kemp, Vic said in a small, strangled voice. He couldn't hold the tears back now. The tears were going to come. He could feel them running down his face.
Kemp did it. I'm sure it was Kemp. Oh, my Christ, what if he's got them?
Who is this Kemp? Bannerman asked. His voice was not embarrassed now. It was sharp and demanding.
He held the phone in his right hand. He put his left hand over his eyes, shutting out Roger, shutting out the hotel room, the sound of the TV, everything. Now he was in blackness, alone with the unsteady sound of his voice and the hot, shifting texture of his tears.
"Steve Kemp," he said. "Stephen Kemp. He ran a place called the Village Stripper there in town. He's gone now. At least my wife said he was gone. He and my wife, Donna, they had an affair, banging each other. It didn't last long. She told him it was over. I found out because he wrote me a note. It was a pretty ugly note. He was getting his own back, I guess. I guess he didn't like to get brushed off much.
It sounds like a grander version of that note.
He rubbed his hand viciously across his eyes, making a galaxy of red shooting stars.
Maybe he didn't like it that the marriage didn't just blow apart, or maybe he's just fucked up. Donna said he got fucked up when he lost a tennis match, wouldn't shake hands over the net. It's a question...
Suddenly his voice was gone, and he had to clear his throat before it would come back. There was a band around his chest, tightening and loosening, then tightening again.
I think it's a question of how far he might go. He could have taken them, Bannerman. He's capable of it, from what I know of him.
There was a silence at the other end. No, not quite silence. The scratching of a pencil on paper. Roger put his hand on Vic's shoulder again, and this time he let it stay, grateful for the warmth. He felt very cold.
Mr. Trenton, do you have the note Kemp sent you?
No, I tore it up. I'm sorry, but under the circumstances...
Was it by any chance printed in block letters?
Yes. Yes, it was.
Officer Fisher found a note written in block letters on the message board in the kitchen. It said, I left something upstairs for you, baby.
Vic grunted a little.
The last faint hope that it might have been someone else, a thief or maybe just kids, blew away.
Come on upstairs and see what I left on the bed. It was Kemp.
The line on the note minder at home would have fit right into Kemp's little note.
The note seems to indicate that your wife wasn't there when he did it, Bannerman said.
But even in his shocked state, Vic heard a false note in the sheriff's voice.
She could have walked in while he was still there, and you know it. Vic said dully. Back from shopping, back from getting the carb adjusted on her car, anything.
What sort of car did Kemp drive, do you know?
I don't think he had a car. He had a van.
Color?
I don't know.
Mr. Trenton, I'm going to suggest you come on up from Boston. I'm going to suggest that if you rent a car, you take it easy. It would be one hell of a note if your people turned up just fine and you got yourself killed on the interstate coming up here.
Yes, all right.
He didn't want to drive anywhere, fast or slow. He wanted to hide. Better still, he wanted to have the last 6 days over again.
"Another thing, sir."
"What's that?"
"On your way up here, try to make a mental list of your wife's friends and acquaintances in the area. It's still perfectly possible that she could be spending the night with someone."
"Sure."
"The most important thing to remember right now is that there are no signs of violence. The whole downstairs is ripped to hell," Vic said. "That sounds pretty fucking violent to me."
"Yes," Bannerman said uncomfortably.
"Well, I'll be there," Vic said. He hung up.
"Vic, I'm sorry," Roger said.
Vic couldn't meet his old friend's eyes.
"Wearing the horns," he thought. "Isn't that what the English call it? Now Roger knows I'm wearing the horns."
"It's all right," Vic said, starting to dress.
"All this on your mind, and you went ahead with the trip?"
"What good would it have done to stay home?" Vic asked.
"It happened. I only found out on Thursday. I thought some distance, time to think, perspective. I don't know all the stupid goddamn things I thought. Now this."
"Not your fault," Roger said earnestly.
"Raj, at this point I don't know what's my fault and what isn't. I'm worried about Donna and I'm out of my mind about Tad. I just want to get back there. And I'd like to get my hands on that fucker Kemp. I'd..."
His voice had been rising. It abruptly sank. His shoulders sagged. For a moment he looked drawn and old and almost totally used up. Then he went to the suitcase on the floor and began to hunt for fresh clothes.
"Call Avis at the airport, would you, and get me a car? My wallet's there in the nightstand. They'll want the American Express number."
"I'll call for both of us. I'm going back with you."
"No.
But nothing."
Vic slipped into a dark blue shirt. He had it buttoned halfway up before he saw he had it wrong. One tail hung far below the other. He unbuttoned it and started again. He was in motion now, and being in motion was better, but that feeling of unreality persisted. He kept having thoughts about movie sets, where what looks like Italian marble is really just contact paper, where all the rooms end just above the camera's sightline, and where someone is always lurking in the background with a clapperboard. Scene number 41, Vic convinces Roger to keep on plugging, take one. He was an actor, and this was some kind of crazy absurdist film. But it was undeniably better when the body was in motion.
"Hey, man."
"Roger, this changes nothing in the situation between Adworks and the Sharp Company. I came along after I knew about Donna and this guy Kemp, partly because I wanted to keep up a front. I guess no guy wants to advertise when he finds out his wife has been getting it on the side. But mostly because I knew that the people who depend on us have to keep eating, no matter who my wife decides to go to bed with."
"Go easy on yourself, Vic. Stop digging yourself with it."
"I can't seem to do that," Vic said. "Even now, I can't seem to do that. And I can't just go on to New York as if nothing's happened."
"As far as we know, nothing has.
The cop kept emphasizing that to me. You can go on. You can see it through. Maybe it'll turn out to have been nothing but a charade all along, but people have to try, Roger. There's nothing else to do. Besides, there's nothing you can do back in Maine except hang out."
"Jesus, it feels wrong. It feels all wrong."
"It's not. I'll call you at the Biltmore as soon as I know something."
Vic zippered his slacks and stepped into his loafers.
"Now go on and call Avis for me. I'll catch a cab out to Logan from downstairs. Here, I'll write my Amex number down for you."
He did this, and Roger stood silently by as he got his coat and went to the door.
He turned, and Roger embraced him clumsily but with surprising strength. Vic hugged him back, his cheek against Roger's shoulder.
"I'll pray to God everything's okay," Roger said hoarsely.
"Okay," Vic said, and went out.
The elevator hummed faintly on the way down, not really moving at all, he thought. It's a sound effect. Two drunks supporting each other got on at lobby level as he got off.
Extras, he thought.
He spoke to the doorman, another extra, and after about 5 minutes a cab rolled up to the Blue Hotel awning. The cab driver was black and silent. He had his radio tuned to an FM soul station. The Temptations sang power endlessly as the cab took him toward Logan Airport through streets that were almost completely deserted.
Hell of a good movie set, he thought.
As the Temptations faded out, a jive-ass DJ came on with the weather forecast.
It had been hot yesterday, he reported, but you didn't see nothing yesterday, brothers and sisters. Today was going to be the hottest day of the summer so far, maybe a record breaker. The Big G's weather prognosticator, Altitude Lou McNally, was calling for temperatures of over 100 degrees inland and not much cooler on the coast. A mass of warm, stagnant air had moved up from the south and was being held in place over New England by bands of high pressure.
So, if your gas gonna reach, you're gonna head for the beach, the jive-ass DJ finished. It ain't gonna be too pretty if you hangin' out in the city. And just to prove the point, here's Michael Jackson. He's going off the wall.
The forecast meant little or nothing to Vic, but it would have terrified Donna even more than she already was, had she known. As she had the day before, Charity awoke just before dawn. She awoke listening, and for a few moments she wasn't even sure what she was listening for. Then she remembered. Boards creaking, footsteps. She was listening to see if her son was going to go walking again. But the house was silent. She got out of bed, went to the door, and looked out into the hall. The hall was empty. After a moment's debate, she went down to Brett's room and looked in on him. There was nothing showing under his sheet but a lick of his hair. If he had gone walking, he had done it before she woke up. He was deeply asleep now. Charity went back to her room and sat on her bed, looking out at the faint white line on the horizon. She was aware that her decision had been made, somehow, secretly, in the night while she slept. Now, in the first cold light of day, she was able to examine what she had decided, and she felt that she could count the cost. It occurred to her that she had never unburdened herself to her sister Holly as she had expected she would do. She still might have, if not for the credit cards at lunch yesterday. And then last night she had told Charity how much this, that, and the other had cost, the Buick four-door, the Sony color set, the parquet floor in the hallway. As if, in Holly's mind, each of these things still carried invisible price tags, and always would. Charity still liked her sister. Holly was giving and kind-hearted, impulsive, affectionate, warm. But her way of living had forced her to close off some of the heartless truths about the way she and Charity had grown up poor in rural Maine, the truths that had more or less forced Charity into marriage with Joe Camber. While luck, really no different from Charity's winning lottery ticket, had allowed Holly to meet Jim and escape the life back home forever. She was afraid that if she told Holly that she had been trying to get Joe's permission to come down here for years, that this trip had only occurred because of brutal generalship on her part, and that even so it had almost come down to Joe strapping her with his leather belt. She was afraid that if she told Holly those things, her sister's reaction would be horrified anger rather than anything rational and helpful. Why horrified anger? Perhaps because deep down in a part of the human soul where Buick station wagons and Sony color TVs with Trinitron picture tubes and parquet floors can never quite make their final stilling impact,
Holly would recognize that she might have escaped a similar marriage, a similar life, by the thinnest of margins. She hadn't told because Holly had entrenched herself in her upper-middle-class suburban life like a watchful soldier in a foxhole. She hadn't told because horrified anger could not solve her problems. She hadn't told because no one likes to look like a freak in a sideshow, living through the days and weeks and months and years with an unpleasant, uncommunicative, sometimes frightening man. Charity had discovered there were things you didn't want to tell. Shame wasn't the reason. Sometimes it was just better, kinder, to keep up a front. Mostly she hadn't told because these things were her problems. What happened to Brett was her problem. And over the last 2 days she had come more and more to believe that what he did with his life would depend less on her and Joe in the final reckoning than it would on Brett himself. There would be no divorce. She would continue to fight her unceasing guerrilla war with Joe for the boy's soul, for whatever good that would do. In her worry over Brett's wanting to emulate his father, she had perhaps forgotten, or overlooked, the fact that there comes a time when children stand in judgment, and their parents, mother as well as father, must stand in the dock. Brett had noticed Holly's ostentatious display of credit cards. Charity could only hope Brett would notice that his father ate with his hat on, among other things. The dawn was brightening. She took her robe from the back of the door and put it on. She wanted a shower, but would not take one until the others in the house were stirring. The strangers, that was what they were. Even Holly's face was strange to her now, a face that bore only a faint resemblance to the snapshots in the family albums she had brought with them. Even Holly herself had looked at those photographs with a faint air of puzzlement. They would go back to Castle Rock, back to the house at the end of Town Road Number 3, back to Joe. She would pick up the threads of her life, and things would continue. That would be best. She reminded herself to call Alva just before 7 o'clock, when he would be at breakfast. It was just past 6 a.m., and the day was coming bright when Tad had his convulsion. He had awakened from an apparently sound sleep around 5:15 and had roused Donna from a low doze, complaining of being hungry and thirsty. As if he had pressed a button deep down inside her, Donna had become aware for the first time that she was hungry, too. The thirst she had been aware of, it was more or less constant. But she could not remember actually thinking of food since sometime yesterday morning. Now she was suddenly ravenous. She soothed Tad as best she could, telling him hollow things that no longer meant anything real to her one way or another, that people would show up soon, the bad dog would be taken away, they would be rescued. The real thing was the thought of food. Breakfasts, for instance. Take breakfasts. 2 eggs fried in butter, over easy if you don't mind, waiter. French toast, big glasses of fresh-squeezed orange juice so cold that moisture beaded the glass. Canadian bacon, home fries, bran flakes and cream with a sprinkle of blueberries on top. Bluebies, her father had always called them, another one of those comic irrationalities that had irritated her mother out of all proportion. Her stomach made a loud rumbling sound, and Tad laughed. The sound of his laughter startled her and pleased her with its unexpectedness. It was like finding a rose growing in a rubbish heap. And she smiled back. The smile hurt her lips.
Heard that, huh? I think you must be hungry, too.
Well, I wouldn't turn down an Egg McMuffin if someone threw it my way.
Tad groaned, and that made them both laugh again. In the yard, Cujo had pricked up his ears. He growled at the sound of their laughter.
For a moment he made as if to get to his feet, perhaps to charge the car again. Then he settled wearily back on his haunches, head drooping. Donna felt that irrational lift in her spirits that almost always comes with daybreak. Surely it would be over soon. Surely they had passed the worst. All the luck had been against them, but sooner or later even the worst luck changes. Tad seemed almost his old self, too pale, badly used, terribly tired in spite of his sleep, but still indubitably the Tadder. She hugged him, and he hugged her back. The pain in her belly had subsided somewhat, although the scrapes and gouges there had a puffy, inflamed look. Her leg was worse, but she found she was able to flex it, although it hurt to do so, and the bleeding started again. She would have a scar. The two of them talked for the next 40 minutes or so. Donna, hunting for a way to keep Tad alert and to also pass the time for both of them, suggested 20 questions. Tad agreed eagerly. He had never been able to get enough of the game. The only problem had always been getting one or the other of his parents to play it with him. They were on their 4th game when the convulsion struck. Donna had guessed some 5 questions ago that the subject of the interrogation was Fred Redding, one of Tad's day camp chums, but had been spinning things out. "Does he have red hair?" she said.
"No, he's...
Suddenly Tad was struggling to catch his breath. It came and went in gasping, tearing whoops that caused fear to leap up her throat in a sour, coppery-tasting rush. "Tad? Tad?" Tad gasped. He clawed at his throat, leaving red lines there. His eyes rolled up, showing only the bottoms of the irises and the silvery whites. "Tad!" She grabbed him, shook him. His Adam's apple went up and down rapidly like a mechanical bear on a stick. His hands began to flop aimlessly about, and then they rose to his throat again and tore at it. He began to make animal choking sounds. For a moment, Donna entirely forgot where she was. She grabbed for the door handle, pulled it up, and shoved the door of the Pinto open, as if this had happened while she was in the supermarket parking lot and there was help close by. Cujo was on his feet in an instant. He leaped at the car before the door was more than half open, perhaps saving her from being savaged at that instant. He struck the opening door, fell back, and then came again, snarling thickly. Loose excrement poured onto the crushed gravel of the driveway. Screaming, she yanked the door closed. Cujo leaped at the side of the car again, bashing the dent in a little deeper. He reeled back, then sprang at the window, thudding off it with a dull cracking sound. The silver crack running through the glass suddenly developed 6 tributaries. He leaped at it again, and the safety glass starred inward, still holding together, but sagging now. The outside world was suddenly a milky blur. If he comes again... Instead, Cujo withdrew, waiting to see what she would do next. She turned to her son. Tad's entire body was jerking as if with epilepsy. His back was bowed, his buttocks came out of the seat, thumped back, rose again, thumped back. His face was taking on a bluish color. The veins in his temples stood out prominently. She had been a candy striper for 3 years, her last 2 in high school and the summer following her freshman year at college, and she knew what was happening here. He had not swallowed his tongue. Outside of the more purple mystery novels, that was impossible. But his tongue had slid down his throat and was now blocking his windpipe. He was choking to death in front of her eyes. She grabbed his chin in her left hand and yanked his mouth open. Panic made her rough, and she heard the tendons in his jaw creak. Her probing fingers found the tip of his tongue incredibly far back, almost to where his wisdom teeth would be if they ever grew out. She tried to grip it and couldn't. It was wet and slippery as a baby eel. She tried to squeeze it between her thumb and forefinger, only faintly aware of the lunatic race of her heart. "I think I'm losing him," she thought. "Oh, my dear God, I think I'm losing my son." Now his teeth suddenly clashed down, drawing blood from her probing fingers and from his own cracked and blistered lips. Blood ran down his chin. She was hardly aware of the pain. Tad's feet began to rattle a mad tattoo against the floor mat of the Pinto. She groped for the tip of his tongue desperately. She had it, and it slipped through her fingers again. "The dog! The goddamn dog! It's his fault! Goddamn dog! Goddamn hellhound! I'll kill you, I swear to God!" Tad's teeth clamped down on her fingers again, and then she had his tongue again, and this time she did not hesitate. She dug her fingernails into its spongy top and underside and pulled it forward like a woman pulling a window shade down. At the same time, she put her other hand under his chin and tipped his head back, creating the maximum airway. Tad began to gasp again, a harsh, rattling sound, like the breathing of an old man with emphysema. Then he began to whoop. She slapped him. She didn't know what else to do, so she did that. Tad uttered one final, tearing gasp, and then his breathing settled into a rapid pant. She was panting herself. Waves of dizziness rushed over her. She had twisted her bad leg somehow, and there was the warm wetness of fresh bleeding. "Tad," she swallowed harshly. "Tad, can you hear me?" His head nodded, a little. His eyes remained closed. "Take it as easy as you can. I want you to relax."
"Want to go home, Mommy. The monster."
"Shh, Tadder. Don't talk and don't think about monsters. Here." The monster words had fallen to the floor. She picked the yellow paper up and put it in his hand. Tad gripped it with panicky tightness. "Now, concentrate on breathing slowly and regularly, Tad. That's the way to get home. Slow and regular breaths." Her eyes wandered past him, and once again she saw the splintery bat, its handle wrapped in friction tape, lying in the high weeds at the right side of the driveway. "Just take it easy, Tadder. Can you try to do that?" Tad nodded a little without opening his eyes. "Just a little longer, hun. I promise. I promise." Outside, the day continued to brighten. Already it was warm. The temperature inside the small car began to climb. Vic got home at 5:20. At the time his wife was pulling his son's tongue out of the back of his mouth, he was walking around the living room, putting things slowly and dreamily to rights, while Bannerman, a state police detective, and a detective from the state attorney general's office, sat on the long sectional sofa drinking instant coffee.
"I've already told you everything I know," Vic said. "If she isn't with the people you've contacted already, she's not with anybody."
He had a broom and a dustpan, and he had brought in the box of hefty bags from the kitchen closet. Now he let a pan full of broken glass slide into one of the bags with an atonal jingle.
"Unless it's Kemp."
There was an uncomfortable silence. Vic couldn't remember ever being as tired as he was now, but he didn't believe he would be able to sleep unless someone gave him a shot. He wasn't thinking very well. 10 minutes after he arrived, the telephone had rung, and he had sprung at it like an animal, not heeding the AG's man's mild statement that it was probably for him. It hadn't been. It was Roger, wanting to know if Vic had gotten there and if there was any news. There was some news, but all of it was maddeningly inconclusive. There had been fingerprints all over the house, and a fingerprint team, also from Augusta, had taken a number of sets from the living quarters adjacent to the small stripping shop where Stephen Kemp had worked until recently. Before long, the matching would be done, and they would know conclusively if Kemp had been the one who had turned the downstairs floor upside down. To Vic, it was so much redundancy. He knew in his guts that it had been Kemp.